inside her coat and began fishing around. "Thing is," she said, "I told your Nell our genie's story, and Nell wrote it down." She pulled out a sheaf of papers. I reached for them, but Nicky snatched them back. "Just a minute," she said. "You've got to understand that this," she shook the pages at me, "is not the whole story. Because even though I told her the whole story, she wouldn't write it all down. Stubborn woman, your sister. Part of the reason I liked her so much. So that's when we had our little disagreement." She settled back in her seat, swinging her legs more vigorously. "I talked her about Jeannie, who was a policewoman back when Lauren died." She coughed loudly. "Jeannie didn't believe she went in without a push, because there was all sorts of other stuff going on, you see. She knew that Lauren's old man was a devil, and that he smacked her about and told stories about her meeting some fancy man up at Anne Ward's place, even though no one had ever seen hide nor hair of such a man. That was supposed to be the reason, see. The bloke she was doing the dirty with, he'd run off and left her, and she was upset about it, so she jumped." Nicky waved a hand at me. "Nonsense. With a 6-year-old at home? Nonsense." "Well, actually," I said, "I think you'll find that depression is a complicated thing." She silenced me with a wave of her hand. "There was no fancy man. None that anyone around here ever saw. You could ask my genie about that, except for the fact that she's dead and gone. And you know who did for her, don't you?" When at last she stopped talking, I heard the water whispering in the quiet. "You're saying that Patrick killed his wife and that Nell knew about it? You're saying that she wrote it down?" Nicky tutted crossly. "No, that's what I'm telling you. She wrote down some things, but not other things. And that's where we disagreed, because she was perfectly happy to write down the things Jeannie told me when she was still alive, but not the things Jeannie told me when she was dead, which makes no sense at all."
"Well,
no sense at all. But you need to listen. And if you won't listen to me," she said, thrusting the pages towards me, "you can listen to your sister, because he did for them. After a fashion, Patrick Townsend did for Lauren, and he did for our genie. And if I'm not mistaken, he's done for your Nell and all."
The Drowning Pool. Lauren, again. 1983. Lauren walked out to Anne Ward's cottage. She went there more and more often these days. It was peaceful in a way that nowhere else in Beckford seemed to be. She felt an odd sort of kinship with poor Anne. She, too, was locked into a loveless marriage with a man who couldn't stand her. Here, Lauren could swim and smoke and read and not be bothered by anyone. Usually. One morning, there were two women out walking. She recognized them. A policewoman, Jeannie, a stout WPC with a ruddy face, and her sister, Nicky, the one who spoke to the dead. Lauren rather liked Nicky. She was funny and seemed kind, even if she was a con artist. Jeannie called out to her, and Lauren waved in a dismissive way that she hoped would see them off. Usually she would have gone over to chat, but her face was a mess and she wasn't in the mood to explain. She went for a swim. She was conscious of doing things one final time. One last walk, one last smoke, one last kiss of her son's pale forehead, one last dip in the river, next to last. As she slipped under the water, she wondered if this was how it would be, whether she would feel anything. She wondered where all her fight had gone. It was Jeannie who arrived at the river first. She'd been at the station watching the storm when the call came. Patrick Townsend had been panicking and incoherent, shouting something over the radio about his wife. His wife in the drowning pool. When Jeannie got there, the boy was under the trees, his head on his knees. At first, she thought he was asleep, but when he looked up, his eyes were wide and black. "Sean," she said, pulling off her coat and wrapping it around him. He was blue-white and shaking, his pajamas sodden, his bare feet caked in mud. "What happened?"
"Mummy's in the water," he said. "I'm to stay here until he comes back."
"Who? Your father? Where's your father?" Sean disentangled one skinny arm from the coat and pointed behind her, and Jeannie saw Patrick dragging himself onto the bank, his breath coming in sobs, his face twisted with agony. Jeannie went to him.
"Sir, the ambulance is on its way. ETA 4 minutes now."
"Too late," Patrick said, shaking his head. "I was too late. She's gone."
Others arrived, paramedics and uniforms and one or two senior detectives. Sean had got to his feet. With Jeannie's coat wrapped around him like a cape, he clung to his father.
"Could you take him home?"
one of the other detectives said to her. The boy began to cry.
"Please, no, I don't want to. I don't want to go."
Patrick said,
"Jeannie, could you take him to your place? He's frightened and he doesn't want to go back home."
Patrick kneeled in the mud, holding his son, cradling his head, whispering in his ear. By the time he stood, the boy seemed calm and docile. He slipped his hand into Jeannie's, trotting along beside her without looking back. Back at her flat, Jeannie got Sean out of his wet things. She wrapped him up in a blanket and made cheese on toast. Sean ate, quietly and carefully, leaning forward over the plate so as not to drop crumbs. When he was finished, he asked,
"Is Mum going to be all right?"
Jeannie busied herself with clearing away the plates. "Are you warm enough, Sean?" she asked him.
"I'm okay."
Jeannie made cups of tea and gave them two sugars each.
"Do you want to tell me what happened, Sean?"
she asked, and he shook his head.
"No. How did he get down to the river? You were terribly muddy." "We went in the car, but I fell over on the path," he said.
"Okay. Did your dad drive you there, then? Or was it your mum?"
"We all went together," Sean said.
"All of you?" Sean's face crumpled.
"There was a storm when I woke up. It was very loud, and there were funny noises in the kitchen."
"What sort of funny noises?"
Like a dog makes when it's sad."
"Like a whimper?" Sean nodded.
"But we don't have a dog because I'm not allowed. Dad says I won't look after it properly, and it'll be just another thing for him to do."
He sipped his tea and wiped his eyes.
"I didn't want to be by myself because of the storm, so Dad put me in the car."
"And your mum?" He frowned.
"Well, she was in the river, and I had to wait under the trees. I'm not supposed to talk about it."
"What do you mean, Sean? What do you mean, not supposed to talk about it?" He shook his head and shrugged, and didn't say another word.
Sean. Howick, near Craster. Not so much history repeating itself as playing games with me. It's not far from Beckford, not much more than an hour's drive, but I never go. I don't go to the beach or the castle. I've never been to eat the famous kippers from the famous smokehouse. That was my mother's thing, my mother's wish. My father never took me, and now I never go. When Tracy told me where the house was, where I would have to go. I felt moved. I felt guilty. I felt the way I had when I thought about my mother's promise of a birthday treat, the one I'd rejected in favour of the Tower of London. If I hadn't been so ungrateful, if I'd said I wanted to go with her to the beach, to the castle, would she have stayed? Would things have turned out differently? That never-to-be-taken trip was one of many subjects that occupied me after my mother died, when my whole being was consumed with constructing a new world, an alternate reality in which she did not have to die. If we had taken the trip to Craster, if I had cleaned my room when I was told, if I hadn't muddied my new school satchel when I went swimming downriver, if I'd listened to me father and hadn't disobeyed him so often, or, later, I wondered whether perhaps I shouldn't have listened to me father, perhaps I should have disobeyed him, perhaps I should have stayed up late that night instead of going to bed, perhaps then I might have been able to persuade her not to go. None of my alternative scenarios did the trick, and eventually, some years later, I came to understand that there was nothing I could have done. What my mother wanted was not for me to do something. It was for someone else to do something, or not do something. What she wanted was for the man she loved, the man she met in secret, the man with whom she'd been betraying my father, not to leave her. This man was unseen, unnamed. He was a phantom. Our phantom, mine and my father's. He gave us the why. He gave us some measure of relief. It wasn't our fault. It was his, or it was hers, theirs together, my traitorous mother and her lover. We couldn't have done any better. She just didn't love us enough. He gave us a way to get up in the morning. A way to go on. And then Nell came along. When she first came to the house, she asked for my father. She wanted to talk to him about my mother's death. He wasn't there that day, and neither was I, so she spoke to Helen, who gave her short shrift. "Not only will Patrick not speak to you," Helen told her, "but he won't appreciate the intrusion, nor will Sean, nor any of us. It is private," Helen said, "and it is past." Nell ignored her and approached Dad anyway. His reaction intrigued her. He wasn't angry, as she might have expected him to be. He didn't tell her it was too painful to talk about, that he couldn't bear to go over all that again. He said there was nothing to talk about. Nothing happened. That's what he said to her. Nothing happened. So, finally, she came to me. It was the middle of summer. I'd had a meeting at the station in Beckford, and when I came out, I found her leaning against my car. She was wearing a dress so long it swept the floor, leather sandals on suntanned feet, bright blue polish on her toes. I'd seen her around before then. I'd noticed her. She was beautiful, hard not to notice. But I'd never until then seen her up close. I'd never realized how green her eyes were, how they gave her this look of otherness. Like she was not quite of this world, certainly not of this place. She was too exotic by half. She told me what my father had said to her, that nothing happened, and she asked me, "Is that how you feel too?" I told her he didn't mean that. He didn't really mean nothing happened. He just meant that we don't talk about it, that it was behind us. We'd put it behind us. "Well, of course you have," she said, smiling at me. "And I understand. But I'm working on this project, you see, a book, and maybe an exhibition too, and I..." "No," I told her. "I mean, I know what you're doing, but we can't be a part of all that. It's shameful." She drew back slightly, but her smile remained. "Shameful? What an odd word to use. What is it that's shameful?" "It's shameful to us," I said. "To him." "To us or to him, I don't remember which of these I said."
"Oh."
The smile fell from her face then. She looked troubled, concerned.
"No. It's not... No, it's not shameful. I don't think anyone thinks like that any longer, do they?"
he does.
Please,
she said,
won't you talk to me?
I think I must have turned away from her because she put her hand on the arm. I looked down and I saw the silver rings on her fingers and the bracelet on her arm and the chipped blue polish on her fingers.
Please, Mr. Townsend, Sean, I've wanted to talk to you about this for such a long time.
She was smiling again. Her way of addressing me, direct and intimate, made it impossible for me to refuse her. I knew then that I was in trouble, that she was trouble, the sort of trouble I'd been waiting for my whole adult life. I agreed to tell her what I remembered about the night of my mother's death. I said I would meet her at her home, at the Mill House. I asked her to keep this meeting private, because it would upset my father. It would upset my wife. She flinched at wife, and smiled again, and we both knew then where it was going. The first time I went to talk to her, we didn't talk at all. So I had to go back. I kept going back to her, and we kept not talking. I would spend an hour with her, or two, but when I left her, it felt as though it had been days. I worried sometimes that I drifted and lost time. I do that occasionally. My father calls it absenting myself, as though it's something I do on purpose, something I can control. But it isn't. I've always done it, ever since childhood. One moment I'm there, and then I'm not. I don't mean for it to happen. Sometimes, when I've drifted away, I become aware of it, and sometimes I can bring myself back. I taught myself a long time ago, I touch the scar on my wrist. It usually works. Not always. I didn't get around to telling her the story, not at the beginning. She pressed me, but I found her pleasingly easy to distract. I imagined that she was falling in love with me, and that we would leave, she and Lena and I. We would uproot ourselves, leave the village, leave the country. I imagined that I would finally be allowed to forget. I imagined that Helen would not mourn me, that she would move on quickly to someone better suited to her steady goodness. I imagined that my father would die in his sleep. She teased the story out of me, strand by strand, and it was clear to me that she was disappointed. It wasn't the story she wanted to hear. She wanted the myth, the horror story. She wanted the boy who watched. I realized then that her approaching my father had been the starter. I was to be the main course. I was to be the heart of her project, because that was how it had started for her, with Libby, and then with me. She coaxed things out of me that I didn't want to tell her. I knew that I should stop, but I couldn't. I knew that I was being sucked into something from which I wouldn't be able to extricate myself. I knew that I was becoming reckless. We stopped meeting at the Mill House because the school holidays were starting and Lena was frequently home. We went to the cottage instead, which I knew was a risk, but there were no hotel rooms to rent, not locally. And where else could we go? It never crossed my mind that I should stop seeing her. Back then, it seemed impossible. My father takes his walks at dawn, so I've no idea why he was there that afternoon. But he was, and he spotted my car. He waited in the trees until Nell had left, and then he beat me. He punched me to the ground, kicked me in the chest and shoulder. I curled myself up, protecting my head, the way I'd been taught. I didn't fight back, because I knew he'd stop when he'd had enough, and when he knew that I couldn't take any more. Afterwards, he took my keys and drove me home. Helen was incandescent, first with me father for the beating, and then with me when he explained the reason for it. I had never seen her angry before. Not like that. It was only when I witnessed her rage, cold and terrifying, that I started to imagine what she might do. how she might take her revenge. I imagined her packing her bags and leaving. I imagined her resigning from the school, the public scandal, my father's anger. That was the sort of revenge I imagined she might take. But I imagined wrong.
Lena. I gasped. I gulped as much air as I could and jammed my elbow into his ribs. He squirmed, but still he held me down. His hot breath in my face made me want to hurl. Too good for you, I kept saying. She was too good for you to touch, too good for you to fuck. You cost her her life, you piece of shit. I don't know how you do it, how you get up every day, how you go to work, how you look her mother in the eye. He scraped the nail hard against my neck, and I closed my eyes and waited for it. You have no idea what I've suffered, he said. No idea. Then he grabbed a fistful of my hair and yanked hard, then let go suddenly so that my head slammed into the table, and I couldn't help it. I started to cry. Mark released me and stood up. He took a few steps back and then walked around to the other side of the table so that he had a good view of me. He stood there and watched me, and I wished more than anything that the earth would just open up and swallow me. Anything was better than him watching me cry. I stood up. I was sobbing like a baby that's lost its dummy, and he started saying, "Stop it. Stop it, Lena. Don't cry like that. Don't cry like that." And it was weird, because then he was crying too, and he kept saying it over and over. Stop crying, Lena. Stop crying. I stopped. We were looking at each other, both of us with tears and snot on our faces, and he still had the nail in his hands, and he said, I didn't do it. What you think I did? I didn't touch your mother. I thought about it. I thought about doing all kinds of things to her, but I didn't. You did, I said. You have her bracelet. You... She came to see me, he said. After Katie died. She told me I had to come clean, for Louise's sake. He laughed, as if she really gave a shit. As if she gave a shit about anyone. I know why she wanted me to say something. She felt guilty about putting ideas into Katie's head. She felt guilty and she wanted someone else to take the blame. She wanted to put it all on me, the selfish bitch. I watched him turning the nail over in his hands, and I pictured myself lunging at him, grabbing it and driving it into his eyeball. My mouth was dry. I licked my lips and tasted salt. He kept talking. I asked her to give me some time. I told her that I would speak to Louise. I just needed to get straight what to say, how to explain it. I persuaded her. He looked down at the nail in his hands and then back at me. You see, Lena, I didn't need to do anything to her. The way to deal with women like that, women like your mother, is not through violence, but through their vanity. I've known women like her before, older women, the wrong side of 35, losing their looks. They want to feel wanted. You can smell the desperation a mile off. I knew what I had to do, even though it made my flesh crawl to think about it. I had to bring her on side, charm her, seduce her. He paused, rubbing the back of his hand over his mouth. I thought maybe I'd take some pictures of her, compromise her, threaten to humiliate her. I thought maybe then she'd leave me alone, leave me to grieve. He raised his chin a little. That was my plan. But then Helen Townsend stepped in, and I didn't have to do anything. He tossed the nail to one side. I watched it bounce on the grass and come to rest against the wall. What are you talking about? I said. What do you mean? I'll tell you. I will. Only... He sighed. You know I don't want to hurt you, Lena. I've never wanted to hurt you. I had to hit you when you came at me back at the house. What else could I do? I won't do it again, though. Not unless you make me, okay? I said nothing. This is what I need you to do. I need you to go back to Beckford, to tell the police that you ran away, you hitchhiked, whatever. I don't care what you tell them, only you have to say that you lied about me. You made all this up. Tell them you made it up because you were jealous, because you were mad with grief, maybe just because you're a spiteful, attention-seeking little bitch. I don't care what you tell them, okay? Just so long as you tell them you lied. I squinted at him. Why do you think I would do that? Seriously? What the fuck would make me do that? It's too late in any case. Josh spoke to them. I wasn't the one who... Tell them Josh lied, then. Tell them you told Josh to lie. Tell Josh that he has to retract his story, too. I know you can do it. And I think you will do it, too. Because if you do that, not only will I not hurt you, but... He slid his hand into the pocket of his jeans and pulled out the bracelet. I'll tell you what you need to know. You do this one thing for me, and I'll tell you what I know. I walked over to the wall. I had my back to him, and I was shaking, because I knew he could come for me. I knew he could finish me off if he wanted to. But I didn't think he did want to. I could see that. He wanted to run. I nudged the nail with the toe of my shoe. The only real question was I going to let him? I turned round to face him, my back to the wall. I thought about all the stupid mistakes I'd made on the way here, and how I wasn't about to make another one. I played scared. I played grateful. Do you promise? Will you let me go back to Beckford? Please, Mark, do you promise? I played relieved. I played desperate. I played contrite. I played him. He sat down and placed the bracelet in front of him in the middle of the table. I found it, he said bluntly, and I started to laugh. You found it? Well, like in the river, where the police searched for days. Give me a fucking break. He sat quietly for a second, and then looked at me as if he hated me more than anyone on earth, which he probably did. Are you going to listen or not? I leaned back against the wall. I'm listening. I went to Helen Townsend's office, he said. I was looking for... He looked embarrassed. Something of hers. Katie's. I wanted... Something I could hold. He was trying to make me feel sorry for him. And it wasn't working. I was looking for a key to the filing cabinet. I looked in Helen's desk drawer and found it. You found my mother's bracelet in Mrs. Townsend's desk. He nodded. Don't ask me how it got there, but if she was wearing it that day, then... Mrs. Townsend, I repeated stupidly. I know it makes no sense, he said. Only it did, or it could, at a stretch. I would never have dreamed her capable. She's an uptight old bitch, I know that. But I would never have imagined her hurting anyone physically. Mark was staring at me. There's something I'm not getting, isn't there? What did she do? To Helen. What did your mother do to her? I said nothing. I turned my face away from him. A cloud passed in front of the sun, and I felt as cold as I had in his house that morning. Cold inside and out. Cold all the way through. I walked over to the table and picked up the bracelet, then slid it over my fingers and onto my wrist. There, he said. I've told you now. I've helped you, haven't I? Now it's your turn. My turn. I walked back over to the wall, crouched down and picked up the nail. I turned back to face him. Lena, he said. And I could tell by the way he said my name, by the way he was breathing short and fast, that he was afraid. I've helped you. You think Katie drowned herself because she was scared I would betray her, or because she was scared that my mother would betray her, that someone would betray you both, and then everyone would know, and she'd be in so much trouble, and her parents would be devastated. But you know that isn't really it, don't you? He bowed his head, his hands gripping the edge of the table. You know that's not really the reason. The reason is that she was afraid of what might happen to you. He kept staring at the table. He didn't move. She did it for you. She killed herself for you. And what have you done for her? His shoulders were starting to shake. What have you done? You've lied and lied. You denied her completely, like she meant nothing to you, like she was no one to you. Don't you think she deserved better? With the nail in my hand, I walked over to the table. I could hear him blubbering and saying sorry. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, he was saying. Forgive me, God forgive me. Bit late for that, I said. Don't you think?
Sean. I was about halfway there when it started to rain, a light drizzle that suddenly turned into a downpour. Visibility was next to nothing, and I had to slow to a crawl. One of the uniforms dispatched to the house in Howick rang, and I put him on speaker. Nothing here, he said over a crackling line. Nothing? No one here. There's a car. A red Vauxhall, but no sign of him. Lena? No sign of either of them. The house is all locked up. We're looking. We'll keep looking. The car is there, but they are not, which means that they must be on foot somewhere. And why would they be on foot? Car broke down? If he got to the house and he found he couldn't get inside, couldn't haul up there, why not just break in? Surely that's better than running. Unless someone picked them up, a friend, someone helping him. Perhaps someone might help him out of a tight spot, but we were talking about a schoolteacher, not some habitual criminal. I couldn't imagine him having the sort of friends who would get involved in a kidnapping. And I wasn't sure if that made me feel better or worse, because if Lena wasn't with him, we had no clue where she was. No one had seen her for almost 24 hours. The thought was enough to make me panic. I needed to make her safe. After all, I'd failed her mother so badly. I'd stopped seeing Nell after the incident with my father. In fact, I did not spend another moment alone in her company until after Katie Whittaker's death, and then I had no choice. I had to question her, given her link to Katie via her daughter, given the allegations that Louise was throwing around. I interviewed her as a witness, which, of course, was unprofessional. A good deal of my conduct over the past year could fall under that description. But once I had become entangled with Nell, that seemed to be an inevitability. There was nothing I could do about it. It felt like grief, seeing her again, because I sensed almost immediately that the Nell from before, the one who had smiled so candidly, who had grabbed hold of me, who had so bewitched me, was no longer there. She hadn't disappeared so much as receded, withdrawn into another self, one I didn't know. My idle imaginings, a new life with her and Lena, Helen left contentedly behind, seemed embarrassingly childish. The Nell that opened her door to me that day was a different woman, strange and unreachable. Guilt spilled out of her during our interview, but it was an amorphous, non-specific guilt. Nell was still committed to her work. She insisted that the drowning pool project had nothing to do with Katie's tragedy, and yet she radiated culpability. Her sentences all prefaced with, I should have, or we should have, or I didn't realize. But what she should have done, what she didn't realize, we didn't seem to get to. Knowing what I know now, I can only imagine that her guilt was about Henderson, that she must have known something or suspected something, and yet done nothing. After the interview, I left her at the Mill House and went to the cottage. I waited for her, in hope more than expectation. It was after midnight when she arrived, not entirely sober, tearful, on the edge. Afterwards, at dawn, when we were finally finished with each other, we went out to the river. Nell was hyper, manic almost. She talked with the passion of a zealot about the truth, how she was tired of telling stories. She just wanted the truth. The truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. I said to her, "You know better than that, don't you? Sometimes, with things like these, there is no truth to be found. We can't ever know what was going through Katie's mind." She shook her head. "Not that. It's not just that. It's not just..." Her left hand gripped mine, her right tracing circles in the dirt. "Why," she whispered, not looking at me, "does your father keep this place? Why does he look after it the way he does?" "Because if this was the place your mother came, if this was the place where she betrayed him, why, Sean? It makes no sense." "I don't know," I said. I'd wondered the same thing myself, but I'd never asked him about it. We don't talk about that.
"And this man, this lover, why does no one know his name? Why did no one ever see him?"
"No one? Just because I didn't see him, Nell.
Nicky Sage told me that no one knew who this man was."
"Nicky?" I had to laugh. "You're talking to Nicky. You're listening to Nicky."
"Why does everyone dismiss what she says?" she snapped at me. "Because she's an old woman. Because she's ugly.
Because she's crazy." "Right," she muttered to herself. "Bitches be crazy. Oh, come on, Nell. She's a fraudster. She claims to commune with the dead."
"Yes."
Her fingers dug deeper into the soil.
"Yes, she's a con artist, but that doesn't mean everything that comes out of her mouth is a lie."
"You'd be surprised, Sean, at how much of what she says rings true." "She called Reeds, Nell. And in your case, she doesn't even need to call Reed. She knows what you want from her. She knows what you want to hear." She fell silent. Her fingers stopped moving. And then it came from her, a whisper, a hiss.
"Why would Nicky imagine I wanted to hear that your mother was murdered?"
Lena. There was no room for guilt. All the space was taken up with relief, grief. That weird feeling of lightness you get when you wake up from a nightmare and realize it isn't real. But that wasn't even true, because the nightmare was still real. Mum was no less gone, but at least she didn't choose to go. She didn't choose to leave me. Someone took her, and that was something, because it meant there was something I could do about it. For her and for me. I could do whatever it took to make sure Helen Townsend paid. I was running along the coastal path, clasping Mum's bracelet to my wrist. I was terrified that it was going to drop off and go sliding down the cliff into the sea. I wanted to put it in my mouth for safekeeping, like crocodiles do with their babies. Running on the slippery path felt dangerous, because I could have fallen, but safe at the same time. You can see a really long way in either direction. So I knew there was no one behind me. Of course there was no one behind me. No one was coming. No one was coming for me. Not to get me. Not to help me. And I didn't have my phone, and I had no fucking idea whether it was in Mark's house or in his car, or whether he'd taken it and thrown it away. And it wasn't like I could ask him now, was it? I'd no room for guilt. I had to focus. Who could I turn to? Who was going to help me? I could see buildings a little way up ahead, and I started to run harder, as fast as I could. I let myself imagine that someone there would know what to do, that someone there would have all the answers.
Sean. My phone buzzed in its holder, snapping me back to the present.
"Sir?"
It was Erin.
"Where are you?"
On me way to the coast. Where are you? Did Louise have anything to say? There was a long pause. So long, I thought she perhaps hadn't heard me. Did Louise have anything to say about Lena?
No.
She didn't sound convinced. What's going on?
Look, I need to talk to you, but I don't want to do this on the phone.
What? Is it Lena? Tell me now, Erin. Don't mess about.
It's not urgent. It's not Lena. It's...
For Christ's sake, if it's not urgent, why are you ringing me?
I need to talk to you the second you're back in Beckford, she said.
She sounded cold and angry.
You got that?
She cut the call. The downpour abating, I accelerated, snaking down narrow roads flanked by high hedges. I had that dizzied sense again, like going too fast on a roller coaster, light-headed with adrenaline. I whipped through a narrow stone arch and down a slope, then up again as the road climbed over the brow of a hill, and there it was. A little harbour, fishing boats rising and falling on the impatient tide. The village was quiet, presumably thanks to the awful weather. So this was Cruster. The car slowed without my even registering I was braking. A few hardy walkers, draped in tent-like anoraks, trudged through puddles as I pulled over to park. I followed a young couple, running to take refuge, and found a group of pensioners huddled over mugs of tea in the cafe. I showed them pictures of Lena and Mark, but they hadn't seen them. They said they'd already been asked not half an hour earlier by a copper in uniform. As I walked back to the car, I passed the very smokehouse where my mother had promised to take me for kippers. I tried to picture her face, as I did sometimes, but I never succeeded. I think I wanted to relive her disappointment when I told her I didn't want to come here. I wanted to feel the pain, her pain then, my pain now. But the memory was too muddied. I drove on the half mile or so to Howick. The house was easy enough to find. It was the only one there, perched precariously on a clifftop, looking out to sea. As expected, a red Vauxhall was parked out back. Its boot was open. As I dragged myself out of the car, my feet heavy with dread, one of the PCs came over to give me an update. Where they were looking. What they'd found. They were talking to the Coast Guard.
Sea's quite rough, so if either of them was in there, they could have been washed quite some way in a short space of time, he said. Of course, we don't know when they got here, or...
He led me over to the car, and I peered into the boot.
"You can see," he said. "It looks as though someone's been in there."
He pointed to the smear of blood on the carpet, another on the rear window. A strand of blonde hair was caught on the lock mechanism, just like the one found in the kitchen. He showed me the rest of the scene, smears of blood on the garden table, on the wall, on a rusty nail. I had failed her, like I had failed my mother. No, her mother. I'd failed her, like I'd failed her mother. I could feel myself drifting again. The sense that I was losing my grip. And then...
Sir, we've got a call. A shopkeeper in the next village up the coast. Says he's got a girl in there, soaked through and a bit bashed up. No idea where she is, asking him to call the police.
There was a bench outside the shop, and she was sitting on it, her head tilted back, her eyes closed. She was draped in a dark green jacket which was too big for her. As the car pulled up, she opened her eyes.
Lena!
I leapt out of the car and ran towards her.
Lena!
Her face was ghostly white, save for a smear of bright blood on her cheek. She said nothing, just shrank back onto the bench as though she didn't recognize me. As though she had no idea who I was.
Lena, it's me. Lena, it's okay. It's me.
I realized when her expression didn't change, when I held out my hand to her and she shrank away still further, that something was wrong. She saw me just fine. She wasn't in shock. She knew who I was. She knew who I was. And she was afraid of me. It brought something back to me sharply, a look I'd seen on her mother's face once, and on the face of the policewoman, Jeannie, when she took me home. Not just fear, but something else. Fear and incomprehension. Fear and horror. It reminded me of the look I gave myself sometimes, if I ever made the mistake of catching my eye in the mirror.
Jules. After Nicky left, I went upstairs to your bedroom. Your bed was stripped bare, so I went to your wardrobe and pulled out one of your coats, caramel cashmere, softer and more luxurious than anything I could dream about owning. I wrapped myself in it, and still I felt colder than I had in the water. I lay on your bed for a long time, too stiff and too tired to move. I felt as though I were waiting for my bones to warm up, for my blood to circulate once more, to restart my heart. I was waiting to hear you in my head, but you were silent. "Please, Nell," I thought. "Please talk to me." I said I was sorry. I imagined your icy riposte. All this time, Julia, all I wanted to do was talk to you. And how could you think that of me? How could you think that I would have just dismissed a rape, that I would have taunted you with it? I don't know, Nell. I'm sorry. When still I couldn't hear your voice, I changed tack. Tell me about Lauren, then. Tell me about those troublesome women. Tell me about Patrick Townsend. Tell me whatever it was you were trying to tell me before. But you wouldn't say a word. I could almost feel you sulking. My phone rang, and on its bright blue screen, I saw D.S. Morgan's name. For a second, I didn't dare pick it up. What would I do if something had happened to Lena? How could I ever atone for all the mistakes I'd made if she, too, was gone? My hand trembling, I answered. And there, my heart pumped again, pushing warm blood to my extremities. She was safe. Lena was safe. They had her. They were bringing her home. It seemed an age, hours and hours, before I heard a car door slam outside, and I was able to rouse myself, to jump up and throw off your coat and run down the stairs. Erin was already there, standing at the foot of the steps, watching while Sean helped Lena out of his car. She was wearing a man's jacket over her shoulders, and her face was pale and dirty. But she was whole. She was safe. She was fine. Only when she looked up and her eyes met mine, I saw that was a lie. She walked gingerly, placing her feet down carefully, and I knew how that felt. Her arms were wrapped protectively around herself. When Sean reached out an arm to guide her into the house, she flinched. I thought about the man who had taken her, about his proclivities. My stomach turned, and I tasted the sweetness of vodka with orange, felt hot breath on my face, the pressure of insistent fingers on soft flesh. Lena, I said, and she nodded at me. I saw that what I'd taken to be dirt on her face was blood, flaking from her mouth and chin. I reached for her hand, but she only held herself tighter, so I followed her up the steps. In the hallway, we stood facing each other. She shrugged off the jacket and let it fall to the floor. I bent to reach it, but Erin got there first. She picked it up and handed it to Sean, and something passed between them, a look I couldn't read, almost like anger. "Where is he?" I hissed at Sean. Lena was bent over at the sink, drinking water straight from the tap. "Where is Henderson?" I had a simple, savage urge to inflict pain on him, this man who had taken on a position of trust and then abused it. I wanted to grab at him, to twist and rip clean off, to do to him what men like that deserve. "We're looking for him," he said. "We have people looking for him." "What do you mean, looking for him? Wasn't she with him?" "She was, but..." Lena was still bent over the sink, gulping water. "Did you take her to the hospital?" I asked Sean. He shook his head. "Not yet." Lena was very clear that she didn't want to go. There was something in his face I didn't like, something hidden. "But..." "I don't need to go to the hospital," Lena said, straightening up and wiping her mouth. "I'm not hurt. I'm fine." She was lying. I knew exactly what kind of lie she was telling, because I'd told those lies myself. For the first time, I saw myself in her, not you. Her expression was one of fear and defiance. I could see that she was clutching her secret to herself like a shield. You think that the hurt will be less, the humiliation slighter, if no one else can see it. Sean took my arm and guided me out of the room. Very quietly, he said, "She was adamant that she come home first. We can't force her to submit to an examination if she's unwilling, but you need to take her as soon as possible." "Yes, of course I will. But I still don't understand why you don't have him. Where is he? Where's Henderson?" "He's gone," Lena said, suddenly at my side. Her fingers brushed against mine. They felt as cold as her mother's had the last time I touched them. "Gone where?" I asked. "What do you mean, gone?" She wouldn't look at me. "Just gone." Townsend raised an eyebrow. "We've got uniforms out looking. His car is still there, so he can't have gone far." "Where do you think he's gone, Lena?" I asked, trying to meet her eye, but she kept turning away. Sean shook his head, his expression rueful. "I've tried," he said softly. "She doesn't want to talk. I think she's just exhausted." Lena's fingers closed around mine, her breath escaping in a deep sigh. "I am. I just want to sleep. Can we do this tomorrow, Sean? I'm desperate to sleep." The detectives left us with reassurances they would be back. Lena would need to give a formal statement. I watched them walk out to Sean's car. When Erin got into the passenger seat, she slammed the door so hard I was surprised the window didn't shatter. Lena called to me from the kitchen. "I'm starving," she said. "Could you make spaghetti bolognese again, like you did before?" The tone of her voice, the softness in it, was new. It was as surprising as the touch of her hand. "Of course I can," I said. "I'll do that now." "Thank you. I'm just going to go upstairs for a bit. I need to have a shower." I put my hand on her arm. "Lena, no, you can't. You need to go to the hospital first." She shook her head. "No, I really don't. I'm not hurt." "Lena," I couldn't meet her eye as I said it, "you need to be examined before you can shower." She looked momentarily confused, then she dropped her shoulders, shook her head, and stepped towards me. Despite myself, I started to cry. She wrapped her arms around me. "It's okay," she said. "It's okay. It's okay. Just like you had, that night after the water." "He didn't do anything like that." "It wasn't like that. You don't understand. He wasn't some, like, evil sexual predator. He was just a sad old man." "Oh, thank God," I said. "Thank God, Lena." We stood like that, hugging each other for a little while, until I stopped crying and she started. She sobbed like a child, her skinny body crumpling, slipping through my arms to the floor. I crouched down next to her and tried to take her hand, but it was curled tightly into a fist. "It's going to be all right," I told her. "Somehow it will be. I'll take care of you." She looked at me, wordless. She didn't seem to be able to speak. Instead, she held out her hand, her fingers unfurling to reveal the treasure inside. a little silver bracelet with an onyx clasp. And then she found her voice. "She didn't jump," she said, her eyes glittering. I felt the temperature in the room plummet. "Mum didn't leave me. She didn't jump."
Lena. I stood in the shower for a long time with the water as hot as I could stand it. I wanted to scour my skin. I wanted the whole of the past day and night and week and month washed off me. I wanted him washed off me. His filthy house and his fists and the stink of him, his breath, his blood. Julia was kind to me when I got home. She wasn't faking. She was obviously glad that I was back. She was worried about me. She seemed to think that Mark had assaulted me. Like she maybe thought he was some sort of pervert who couldn't keep his hands off teenage girls. I'll give him this. He was right about one thing. People don't understand about him and Kay. They never will. There's a tiny twisted part of me that sort of wishes I believed in an afterlife, and that the two of them could pick up again there. And maybe things might be all right for them, and she'd be happy. As much as I hate him, I'd like to think that somehow Katie could be happy. When I felt clean, or at least as close to clean as I thought it was possible to get, I went to my room and sat on the windowsill, because that's where I do all my best thinking. I lit a cigarette and tried to figure out what I should do. I wanted to ask Mum. I wanted to ask her so badly, but I couldn't think about that because I just stopped crying again, and what good would that be to her? I didn't know whether to tell Julia what Mark had told me, whether I could trust her to do the right thing. Maybe. When I told Julia that Mum didn't jump, I expected her to tell me that I was wrong or crazy or whatever, but she just accepted it, without question, like she knew already. Like she'd always known. I don't even know if the shit Mark told me's true, though it'd be a pretty weird thing to make up. Why point the finger at Mrs. Townsend, when there are more obvious people to blame? Like Louise, for example. But maybe he feels bad enough about the Whittakers, after what he's done to them. I don't know whether he was lying or telling the truth. But either way, he deserved what I said to him. What I did. He deserved everything he got.
Jules. When Lena came back downstairs, her face and hands scrubbed clean, she sat at the kitchen table and ate ravenously. Afterwards, when she smiled and said thank you, I shivered, because now that I have seen it, I can't unsee it. She has her father's smile. What else, I wondered, does she have of his? "What's wrong?" Lena asked suddenly. "You're staring at me." "I'm sorry," I said, my face reddening. I'm glad you're home. I'm glad you're safe." "Me too." I hesitated a moment before going on. "I know you're tired, but I need to ask you, Lena, about what happened today. About the bracelet." She turned her face from me towards the window. "Yeah, I know." "Mark had it?" She nodded again. "And you took it from him?" She sighed. "He gave it to me." "Why did he give it to you? Why did he have it in the first place?" "I don't know." She turned her head back to face me, her eyes blank, shuttered. "He told me he found it." "He found it? Where?" She didn't answer. "Lena, we need to go to the police about this. We need to tell them." She got to her feet and took her plate over to the sink. Her back to me, she said, "We made a deal." "A deal?" "That he would give me Mum's bracelet and let me go home," she said, "so long as I told the police that I'd lied about him and Katie." Her voice was incongruously light as she busied herself with the dishes. "And he believed you would do that?" She raised her skinny shoulders to her ears. "Lena, tell me the truth. Do you believe Mark Henderson was the one who killed your mum?" She turned around and looked at me.